Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident that's going into radiology. This will be the 99th episode of the Divine Intervention podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be studying a USMLE review of rheumatology. This will probably be a two-part podcast and we'll be done with that. Again, I apologize. You've probably not seen podcasts from me in a while. I've just been on an intense ICU rotation that, kind of makes it difficult because, it's the intensive care unit. It's called intensive care unit for a reason. But without much ado, let's go ahead and jump into it, right? So what if you get a question about a patient that has, let's assume they have like a recent history of like a gastric cancer, right? And then they tell you that this patient, is now having like a muscle weakness, like she has like difficulty rising from a chair, and they tell you that it's mostly the proximal muscles that are weak on both upper extremities. And then let's say you do some studies and the serum creatine kinase is like, I don't know, like 1,000, right? And then they tell you that the patient has like this weird rash on their fingers and rash like on their trunk. What disease are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about dermatomyositis, right? So if you notice in this case scenario I just brought up, right, this patient has like some kind of visceral malignancy, right? In this case, a gastric cancer. It could be any other kind of visceral cancer, like it could be like a cancer of the bladder or whatever, right? Some GU cancer or like cancer of the colon or like lung cancer. People that have those cancers, they can actually have dermatomyositis, sort of showing up as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. Polymyositis, a little less so, but polymyositis can also show up as a paraneoplastic phenomenon, usually like in the realm of a lung cancer, but really any kind of like visceral malignancy, like lung cancer and stuff like that, can present as paraneoplastic phenomena in the setting of polymyositis or dermatomyositis, right? And really the hallmarks of these two diseases, right, are basically that the person has proximal muscle weakness, okay? So like your shoulder girdles or your limb girdles are weak, right? So like your shoulders. So the person may have like difficulty rising from a chair, difficulty combing their hair, stuff like that, things that you require your proximal muscles for, okay? And there's two types of those problems, right? So there's polymyositis, there's dermatomyositis. The key thing, right, dermatomyositis has derm in the name. So that already tells you right off the bat that it's a disease that should affect the skin in addition to affecting your muscles, right? So, and again, because it's an autoimmune problem, shows up in women more than men. That's kind of like the way to remember that. And again, right, so dermatomyositis also affects the skin in addition to the muscle. Polymyositis is just muscle problems. There is no skin involved. And really, one high yield thing you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind is, they will say that you need to do a muscle biopsy to make the diagnosis of poly or dermatomyositis. That's no longer true. These days, you can actually make the diagnosis of these disorders by doing an MRI. If the MRI of the muscle is not diagnostic, then you can go ahead and pursue a muscle biopsy, right? So I say that really the key differentiating thing here is like if you see skin problems, think about dermatomyositis. And the skin problems, right, you can have like a rash on the knuckles, right? That's what's known as the classic Guttron's papules. So you can basically see like it's kind of like a rash, like you can look up pictures of this online, but like a rash on like your PIPs, your DIPs, your MCPs, stuff like that. Think about dermatomyositis with that, right? And then, right, heliotrope rash, right? That's another classic association where you see like redness or like blue around the person's eyes. That's one other thing you can see classically in patients with dermatomyositis, right? Sometimes they can actually also have like lesions on their nose, right? So I know that in in lupus, right? You guys have probably learned that, oh, lupus can cause a malar rash that spares the nasolabial folds. Believe it or not, on NBMEs, they have actually been known occasionally to present dermatomyositis questions as a patient that has a malar rash. But the key thing here is that the malar rash in dermatopolymyositis does not spare the nasolabial folds. That's actually a very high yield differentiating factor you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? And then other kind of like key things to keep in mind, right? So you see the you can see like the Schall sign. Basically, you can have like a red discoloration of your skin, either like in front of your body or at the back. If it's at the back, that's where you wear a shawl, right? So it's called the Schall sign. If it's in front, right, that's like the V-neck sign, stuff like that. And again, like I said, right, you do a muscle MRI. MRI can make the diagnosis pretty well. But you can also do a muscle biopsy. But that muscle biopsy, you do it when the results of the muscle MRI are equivocal. And there are certain things I kind of want you to keep at the back of your mind in terms of the histologic findings. The thing is, these histologic findings, they are tested very classically on the USMLE step one, right? So the thing is, in dermatomyositis versus polymyositis, you need to know the kinds of cells that mediate the damage. And the easy way to remember that is that dermatomyositis starts with a D, polymyositis starts with a P, right? And D comes before P in the alphabet. So that means CD4 cells with a lower number, can cause the symptoms in dermatomyositis versus CD8 cells with a higher number that cause the symptoms in polymyositis, right? So you basically have like CD4 positive T cells in dermatomyositis, right? Remember, those are like the one of the sources of your helper T cells. So you can already envisage that this will be some kind of antibody problem, right? So your antibodies basically like nuke your blood vessels. So you may see like blood, and these are like blood vessels that you find in the connective tissue around muscle, right? So the classic buzzword you want to remember for the USMLE exams is something called like perimysial or like perifascicular inflammation. If you see that, you can pretty much stop reading the question. That's a dermatomyositis. Contrast that with a polymyositis, where it's CD8 positive T cells that mediate the damage, but they actually attack the muscle directly, right? So cell mediated, you're trying to attack the cell itself, not the connective tissue surrounding it. So if you attack the muscle itself, right, you get like inflammation of the muscle itself, right? So like the endomysium. So endomysial inflammation, think about polymyositis. Perimysial inflammation, think about perimysial or like perifascicular inflammation, think about a dermatomyositis, right? And again, because you're destroying muscle, anything that you find a ton in muscle will sort of spill into the circulation, right? So like your CK will be high, your lactate dehydrogenase, your LDH will be high, aldolase. Aldolase is an enzyme in glycolysis, right? Basically, like many of those non-specific things, the big one you want to remember is like CK and the LDH and aldolase. So the others, like basically anything that you find in muscle will be elevated, right? So that's those are not super specific for disease. Now, some things I guess I want you to also keep in mind for the USMLEs, and sorry with the ums and ahs, right? Again, I have topics in my mind that I choose to discuss, and then whenever I have free time, I just sort of sit down and just try to record stuff on my phone from memory. So you just kind of want to remember like the antibodies, right, that are associated with poly and dermatomyositis, right? So for example, there's like the SRP antibody, so like the anti-signal recognition particle antibody. I believe I may have talked about this in a prior podcast, probably like my cell physiology podcasts, where I talk about how, remember, right, there are bound ribosomes, right? So ribosomes that are sort of like bound to like endoplasmic reticulum. So I guess in that case it'll be the rough endoplasmic reticulum. As those ribosomes are making proteins, those proteins, the sort of like the guide that sort of threads them into the endoplasmic reticulum is the signal recognition particle, right? So if you make autoantibodies against the signal recognition particle, that's one of the antibodies that's found in the myocytides, if there's such a term as that. And then there's like your anti-JO1 antibody. It's like an antibody against it's a kind of tRNA synthesis, if I'm remembering correctly. I mean tRNA synthetase. If I remember correctly, it's like a histidyl tRNA synthetase, right? Remember, your amino acyl tRNA synthetases are enzymes that help you basically cojoin tRNA, right? I believe it's like the 3' end to the amino acid that you want to incorporate into the growing polypeptide. Okay, so histidyl tRNA synthetase, if you make autoantibodies against that, those are the autoantibodies that are made in the myocytides, right? So that's the anti-JO1 antibody. And then there's another one, kind of weird, it's called like the anti-MI2, so anti-like Me2 antibody. It's just another antibody against like helicase, right? Remember helicase, right? It's the thing that sort of, if you want to make DNA, you need to separate the double strand first, right? So to separate those double strands, you kind of need you need an enzyme to make that happen. And in this case, it's a helicase. So if you make autoantibodies against helicase, those are the anti-MI2 antibodies that characterize, that also characterize poly and dermatomyositis, right? And really, like, again, muscle MRI, you do the biopsy if it's not very, if you're not getting, like, convincing results. And really, for the most part, the way you treat poly dermatomyositis, you can just sort of treat with, like, steroids, right? You can give like all these immunosuppressants like your methotrexate. Remember, methotrexate inhibits dihydrofolate reductase. I've talked about that extensively in my biochem podcast or video, I guess. And you can also use pretty much like your immunosuppressive, any immunosuppressive therapy should be able to work pretty well for poly and dermatomyositis. And personally, I think that's all I want to say about those conditions. Pretty straightforward. Don't get any of those things wrong. I believe I've, at least if I'm sort of running through my mental game or whatever, I believe I've discussed pretty much everything you can see that is testable on those two topics. So let's sort of go ahead to the next topic I have at the back of my mind. Let's see. So how do I present this to you? Okay, let's assume you get a question about a patient that says, Doc, it's kind of hard for me to chew crackers anymore. And I always have like this feeling like there is sand in my eye. If you see that, what, and let's say like you do a physical exam and you sort of see the amount sort of swollen, like they have mumps. What disease are you thinking about? And again, think this is a rheumatology podcast. So what do you think I'm going after here? Going after Sjogren's syndrome, right? Sjogren's syndrome. Basically, the key thing you want to remember of Sjogren's syndrome is you're essentially destroying glandular structures, okay? Glandular structures, especially like the salivary glands and like the lacrimal glands, right? So if you destroy the lacrimal glands, you will make tears. So you have like that feeling like there's sand in the eye. If you destroy your salivary glands, right? Those people can have like really bad dental caries, so they have trouble like swallowing stuff because they don't like kind of like soften the food enough with saliva. So the thing is, unfortunately, many of these rheumatologic problems, no one really knows the pathophysiology. But I mean, from some of the digging I've done, some people actually believe that what may trigger Sjogren's is that these people may actually have like some kind of like viral infection of like their salivary glands or like their lacrimal glands. And then when they have that viral infection, some of those viral antigens or some antigens that are previously like hidden from your immune system become expressed. And then when that happens, your body is like, oh crap, let me go ahead and have T cells that are sort of reactive against, you present some of these antigens to T cells, and then your T cells sort of go nuts and decide to react against these glandular organs, like your salivary or your lacrimal glands, and then the person gets into trouble. One high yield thing you actually kind of want to remember with that for Sjogren's is that it's actually a kind of a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction. That's something that actually shows up quite commonly on exams. And again, it's an autoimmune disease, so who should get it? It's a woman, right? Very unlikely to be a man on an NBME. It's likely going to be a problem with a woman. And there are just certain, I guess, Latin terms, or I don't know if they're Latin terms or whatever, but certain like terms you may see on your exam, right? As like the presentations, right? So I talked about like the dry eye, right? The buzz phrase for that is keratoconjunctivitis sicca, right? And then I talked about the dry mouth. Sometimes you may see that referred to as xerostomia. The thing is, if you actually just have the dry mouth, dry eyes, and that's all you have and you got nothing else, that's actually what's known as a Sicca syndrome. But if you have the dry eyes, the dry mouth, and then you have joint pain, then that is what actually constitutes Sjogren's syndrome. Okay, so it's one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And to be honest, I don't want to forget this. It just sort of popped into my mind right now. But don't forget that Sjogren's syndrome can be associated with renal tubular acidosis. Okay, that's a very high yield renal association. So that's one thing you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind. And really, again, like every other autoimmune disease, you definitely want to know your autoantibodies, right? So remember your anti-SSA. Those are like your anti-RO antibodies. And then you have like your anti-SSB. Those are your anti-LA antibodies, right? They are basically antibodies against like some ribonucleoproteins. Those are like the big ones you definitely want to remember. Although many people with Sjogren's have like their ANA is like positive, right? So remember, ANA is very sensitive for like lupus, but it's not specific for lupus. ANA is elevated in like many other things. So the anti-RO, anti-LA, right? So those are things you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind. They are your anti-SSA, anti-SSB antibodies. The key things you want to remember is that these antibodies, if a pregnant woman has them in high enough titer, those things can actually go ahead and cross the placenta and destroy the conducting system of the heart. So the kid can basically, the child of that mom can basically get like a third degree, right? So like a complete heart block. So those kids can get a complete heart block, right? So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with that. And really, you may ask, okay, so how do we treat Sjogren's, right? So you can actually treat Sjogren's by, remember, acetylcholine is the thing, I've talked about this extensively in multiple podcasts. Acetylcholine is the thing that stimulates your glands, right? So like your salivary glands, your lacrimal glands. So if you give a muscarinic receptor agonist, like pilocarpine, for example, that can help to increase secretions and that can decrease some of the symptoms that are found in Sjogren's syndrome. So pilocarpine, there's another drug that's beginning to make its way to the MBMEs. It's known as a sevimeline. It's like C-E-V-I-M-E-L-I-N-E. It's also a muscarinic agonist that can be used to treat the symptoms of Sjogren's. And the thing you want to remember, well, I guess one thing, in fact, is probably one of the most common cause of death in a patient with Sjogren's is that they can, right? Remember, if you take like a biopsy, for example, of their salivary glands, you see like a lot of like lymphocytes, like lymphoid follicles. Those people, wherever lymphocytes are rapidly proliferating, that can lead to a lymphoma, right? So like a marginal zone lymphoma is actually one of the most common causes of death in patients with a Sjogren's syndrome. So that's something you definitely want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And one other thing you may see on exams is like, oh, how can you check to see if this person has like dry eyes. You can actually put like filter paper in their eyes, and then if it doesn't get wet to a certain depth or whatever, you'll sort of like, that's almost like a screener for like lacrimal gland dysfunction. It's called like the Schirmer, I think it's like S-C-H-I-R-M-E-R, like the Schirmer's test. It's a test for the diagnosis of Sjogren's. And again, really, if you take a biopsy of their glands, you'll see like a lot of lymphocytes and lymphoid follicles. So personally, I think that's all I'm going to say about Sjogren's. And I'm going to kind of leave it at that. And I guess with that, I can talk about some other topic. So let's see, how do I want to present this topic? Obviously, I don't want to tell you the topic without giving the clinical presentation first. Okay, so yeah, I think that's it for Sjogren's. So, what if you get a question about a 30-year-old guy presents with like sudden onset, severe chest pain, like tearing chest pain radiating to the back, and they tell you that this patient has a history of, low back pain, right? And like morning stiffness that sort of gets better as they sort of go about their day. What are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about ankylosing spondylitis, right? Ankylosing spondylitis is obviously one of your seronegative spondyloarthropathies, right? And this question I just gave you sort of talks about some high-yield associations with ankylosing spondylitis. The thing is, ankspond, one of its, I guess, extra joint manifestations are The person can have like inflammation of the aorta, so they can get like an aortitis, and it can ultimately end up causing like aortic regurg, right? And they can get like heart failure from that. So they will get more of like a systolic heart failure, right? Because they are getting like volume overload in the heart. Another thing you want to keep in mind with ankylosing spondylitis is it's also associated with like inflammation of the uvea, right? So they can get like an anterior uveitis. They can even get like a kind of like restrictive lung disease, because when they get like kyphosis, right, like fusion of the spine, like the bamboo spine, that can sort of prevent the lung from expanding appropriately, right? So they can have like a kind of restrictive lung disease. They will have like the low lung volumes, but the DLCO for those people will actually be normal, right? So if you get like a restrictive pattern, right, so the FEV1 to FVC ratio is normal or elevated, but the DLCO is normal, you want to think of some kind of like neuromuscular or like structural disease that's giving rise to that person's restrictive physiology. Ankylosing spondylitis could be one of them on an exam. So again, if you notice from my podcast, it's not just about like, take this concept. At the end of the day, I sort of want you to understand how these things will be tested, right? And the thing is, your friends at the MBME, they're geniuses at integrating concepts together across multiple disciplines. That's kind of like the best way to learn in the first place. So that's ankylosing spondylitis, right? And again, classic presentation, low back pain, because you tend to have like involvement of the sacroiliac joints, right? So sacroiliitis, once you see that word on an MBM exam, you can pretty much stop reading the question. They are basically talking about ankylosing spondylitis. And ankylosing spondylitis will not show up in a guy that's in his 60s on an MBM. If you see a person that is not ankylosing spondylitis, it's like a young man's problem, right? So it's like a guy in his 20s, 30s, right? Sort of having like the low back pain. With that, think more about ankylosing spondylitis. And the thing is, there are just some buzz phrases you want to be able to remember with ankspond. And one of them is like the term synovitis. It's basically like an inflammation of the joint, right? Like your synovium is one of the epithelium that basically produces like things that nourish your joints, right? So you can have like synovitis. Another term you may see on an MBME is like enthesitis. Basically, whenever like a ligament attaches to bone, you can actually have inflammation of that region, right? That's what's known as the enthesitis. And then another thing you may see on an MBME is something called a syndesmophyte. Basically, it's, again, it's right around like that tendon ligament area, and you begin to have like spinal fusion and all that crap happening. But just sort of keep that at the back of, keep these buzzwords like enthesitis, synovitis, syndesmophytes, keep them at the back of your mind when you're talking about ankylosing spondylitis. And classically, right, these patients on MBMEs, they get like a bamboo spine. That's part of what like restricts, causes like restrictive problems with their lungs. And one thing I guess want to mention that you want to keep in mind, but this is more for step 2 CK, but it may be one of those like 270 sort of questions on step 1. If a person has a history of ankylosing spondylitis, and let's say they want to start participating in sports, or they want to get like some kind of surgery where you need to manipulate their necks, and then the MBME says, what is the next best step in management? For those people, you want to go ahead and get a lateral neck x-ray, okay? The reason you want to do that is you want to rule out atlantoaxial instability. It's actually a phenomenon that has been described in patients that have a history of ankylosing spondylitis, because you don't want to have like spinal injury and then they become permanently quadriplegic if you over manipulate their cervical spine. So those people, you need to go ahead and perform a lateral neck x-ray, rule out atlantoaxial instability. Two other classic patient populations where this similar concept is tested is like Down syndrome, right? So Down syndrome, before they start participating in sports, again, rule out AA instability. Another classic presentation is patients with rheumatoid arthritis, right? Those people are also at high risk for atlantoaxial instability. So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for the USMLE exams. And personally, to be honest, I think that's all I'm going to say about ankylosing spondylitis. Again, it's a seronegative spondyloarthropathy. So obviously, those people will be HLA-B27 positive. Rheumatoid factor will obviously be negative for these people. And really, ankylosing spondylitis, people tend to have like a normal life expectancy. It's not like they die early or like some weird crap. No, they actually live pretty young, but they live to be pretty old, but they can just have like joint problems and like they may be bed bound at some point, but they actually live pretty young. I mean, they live pretty long. It doesn't like reduce their life expectancy. They live especially if they're treated, they live about as long as the next man is standing next to them. And really, the treatment is you can give like indomethacin, like any NSAID, ketorolac, whatever. If that's not cutting it, then you can go for like the big guns, right? Like your TNF inhibitors, like your adalimumab, infliximab, etanercept, that's more of the decoy receptor. Although remember, before you start these drugs, right, you want to go ahead and check those people for like TB, and you also want to check them for hep B, right? Again, you want to check for these bugs before you start treating these people so that they don't get issues and like die or something. And then your other seronegative spondyloarthropathies, right? So don't forget your there's a psoriatic arthritis, right? So obviously this will be found in a person that has a psoriasis. Remember, psoriasis classically presents as like the rash on the extensor surfaces with a silvery scale. These people, for the most part, they tend to get a lot of like finger problems on NBMEs, right? So they can have like peeling of their nails. I would encourage you to look up an x-ray picture of this, the pencil and cup deformity, where basically like their middle phalanx sort of like jabs into the DIP of the proximal phalanx. That's what sort of produces the pencil and cup deformity. They may have like the sausage shaped fingers, right? Like the mechanic's hands. Those are all classic presentations of psoriatic arthritis. You want to keep at the back of your mind for NBMEs. And again, same treatment as ankylosing spondylitis. You give NSAIDs, you give like your methotrexate, whatever, and that sort of helps with the disease. And then there's your reactive arthritis. I believe back in the day it was called like Ryder syndrome. Basically, what do I even want to go ahead and say here? The thing you want to keep in mind is these people, they have reactive arthritis, right? So reactive arthritis means that they're having a reaction to something that happened earlier, right? So the thing that usually happens earlier is either like a GI infection or some kind of sexual infection, right? Sorry, I shouldn't use the word sexual infection. STI, sexually transmitted infection. The sexually transmitted infection is usually from like chlamydia on NBME exams. So that's the one I will keep at the back of my mind. I really would not think about gonorrhea. Gonorrhea is very unusual as a cause of reactive arthritis. Okay, think more about chlamydia. Another one that may show up is this bug that produces a urease, Uroplasma urolyticum. That's another one that shows up on NBME exams. So think about like the STIs and think about the GI infections. And in terms of GI infections, the easy way to remember the bugs that are associated with like GI infections that may ultimately lead to like a reactive arthritis is something called basically the GI bugs that cause bloody diarrhea, right? So like Salmonella or like Campylobacter jejuni. Remember that is also associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome. Shigella, right? Remember, Shigella can cause a bloody diarrhea, and also like Yersinia, the thing that classically causes like the pseudo appendicitis. If you see those things, you really want to think about reactive arthritis. Sorry, I'm just drinking some water. So you see those things, think about a reactive arthritis with that on NBMEs. And really, the only time you give antibiotics to these patients is if they have like you like actually like detect infection, then you can treat. But if not, you don't necessarily need to treat these people. You can like give them NSAIDs, just like again you do for any other seronegative spondyloarthropathy. The inflammatory bowel disease associated arthritis, there's really not much to see there. You just have inflammatory bowel disease, so you don't have Crohn's. Or you have, ulcerative colitis, and then you get arthritis. But let me say a few more things about this reactive arthritis, right? So some of you, probably from your preclinical studies, you probably heard of this mnemonic where they say, oh, can't see, can't pee, can't climb a tree, right? So can't see is these people tend to get like a conjunctivitis, right? The can't pee, they tend to get like urinary issue, like inflammation of the urethra, so they get like a urethritis, and then they get the arthritis, right? So that means they cannot climb a tree. And some other things they may have, so they may use these words to bamboozle you on NBME exams, but basically some people with a reactive arthritis, they can actually on their penis, you may actually see things that kind of look like ulcers. They're kind of like round, they sort of look like tinea. It's like tinea of the penis. If you see that, it's like red, it's like clear in the middle, but it's like a ring. Think about something known as a circinate balanitis, okay? It's kind of like an inflammation around the penis. If you see that, or if they give you like a penis picture on your MBMA exam and you see like round things, and the person has like joint pain, you can pretty much stop reading the question. That's a circinate balanitis, that's a reactive arthritis. Another thing you may see on an MBMA exam is they may show you like something like on the, it's like a almost like a lesion on the palms and soles. It kind of looks like what's this thing that HIV, right? So like the Kaposi's, whatever. It kind of looks like that. I will encourage you to look up pictures of this, but it's something known as a keratoderma blenorrhagica. It's like a like just red, like they're just like tiny lesions. They're like kind of like raised. They kind of look like blue red. You find them on the palms and soles. That's a big thing you want to remember. That's also pathognomonic for reactive arthritis on MBMEs. So those are the things I would strongly recommend remembering about the seronegative spondyloarthropathies. And again, don't forget they are HLA-B27 positive, but they are rheumatoid factor negative. And personally, I think that is all I'm going to say about these seronegative spondyloarthropathies. Now, one other thing I want to talk about. So what if you get a question about a patient that, you know, let's say they're 21 years old, and they tell you that they have like very severe joint pain, and they tell you that it sort of started in their elbows, and then today it has sort of moved to their knees, and then it has moved to their foot, and then they show you a picture of their skin, and they have like pustules, or they have like a pripper on their skin. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? I really, really hope you're thinking about like a gonococcal arthritis, right? Remember, Neisseria gonorrhea, it's a gram-negative diplococcus, tends to show up as a migratory polyarthritis, right? So migratory, it sort of jumps from one area to the other, right? From one joint to the next. And then if you have like pain in the fingers, that's what's known as like a tenosynovitis. So if you see arthritis plus skin findings, the first thing that should come to your mind on MBME exams is gonococcal arthritis, especially in a young person, not an old person. Old people don't do risky things on MBMEs. It's young people that do risky stuff on MBMEs. If you see those things, you really want to think about a gonococcal arthritis, right? And really the way you treat it is you can go ahead and give like ceftriaxone, right? Remember, ceftriaxone is a third generation cephalosporin. Although you want to avoid a ceftriaxone in like neonates, right? Because that can cause like hepatic cholestasis, which is not an ideal outcome for those kids. And also don't forget, I mean, I've mentioned this in many, many podcasts, right? But if you have like a terminal complement component deficiency, so like from C5 to C9, that also increases your risk of recurring Neisseria infections, right? And then I also mentioned this case scenario where if a person is on eculizumab, right? Remember, eculizumab is one of those treatments for paroxysmal or nocturnal hemoglobinuria. If a person is on eculizumab, that eculizumab is a C5 inhibitor. It's a monoclonal antibody against C5. You're basically using pharmacology to induce a terminal complement component deficiency, and that can also, again, increase your risk of recurring Neisseria infections, although there is no vaccine against Neisseria gonorrhea, unlike a Neisseria meningitis. But if a person has arthritis, right, like an infectious arthritis, and they don't give you like those specific scenarios, you want to think more about Staph aureus as the bug that may be causing it. And I mean, you hopefully know the bugs that all the drugs that cover Staph, right? Especially like MRSA, right? Like vancomycin, daptomycin, linezolid, clindamycin, doxycycline, right? Your tigecyclines, right? Those are like your advanced tetracyclines. Those all cover MRSA. Your strep species, right? They can actually also cause like an infectious arthritis, but they tend to be less common on MBMEs. I'll say like really think more about Staph aureus. Don't forget your Lyme disease, right? Your Lyme disease can cause like a chronic arthritis. The thing is, I'll just go ahead and tell you this. If you see a person that has arthritis and it's been going on for a long time, and it's in multiple joints, think more about Lyme disease versus if you see a person suffering from arthritis in one joint and you're thinking about infectious arthritis, think more about like gonorrhea or like Staph aureus. But if you see like multiple joints involved, right? So like a chronic poly, so not mono, polyarthritis, you really want to think about Lyme disease on NBME exams. And then don't forget, right, that Lyme disease is caused by Borrelia burgdorferi. Remember, it's a spirochete, right? Those are just those weird annoying things you want to know for NBMEs. So it's like a spirochete, and remember, it's carried by the Ixodes tick. Right, so that's a classic thing that shows up on exams. And the thing is, don't forget TB, right, and Pott's disease. Remember, TB can cause an infection of vertebral bodies. That's what's known as Pott's disease. If you do like a joint tap of whatever, right, you see like the acid fasta organisms. So personally, I think that's all I'm going to say about the infectious arthritis. Yeah, I think those are the big things there. And I guess I can talk about joint findings, right? So just some key things you want to keep at the back of your mind. If a person has like a red, painful, tender joint, blah, 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 and it's acute onset on an NBME, you want to tap the joint, right? So the bus phrase you're looking for on an exam as your next step in diagnosis is an atherosynthesis. Now, if the white count from that joint fluid or from the joint aspirate is less than 2,000, you can pretty much stop reading the question. That patient has osteoarthritis, so it'll be an old person on an NBME, right? And then, if, for example, you tap the joint and you see like a white count greater than 50,000, that's an infectious arthritis. That's a septic joint. That's a septic arthritis, right? So you want to be thinking about your Staph aureus, your Neisseria, gonorrhea, and all that crap. But if it's like in the tens of thousands, let's say like 10 to 30,000, you want to think more about like some kind of like inflammatory arthritis, especially if you see lymphocytes, right? So you want to think more about like rheumatoid arthritis or like the crystal arthritides, right? So like CPPD or like gout. Remember, gout is where you see the needle-shaped negatively birefringent, needle-shaped negatively birefringent crystals versus CPPD, where it's like the positively birefringent rhomboid-shaped crystals, okay? So those are kind of like ballpark numbers. They're not hard and fast, but they're ballparks, and they're like almost like 99% accurate on NBME exams. So I'd keep those at the back of your mind if I were you. Now, let's see, because I also don't want this podcast to run for too long. Let's see. Trying to see if I should fit in this topic. You know what? Let's go ahead and talk about one more topic. Why not? Might as well do it. Okay. So, what if you get a question about a patient that is brought to the hospital because they have like, like a severe headache, and you measure their blood pressure, and it's like 250 over 180, right? So it's like super crazy high. And you try to like obtain a physical exam on this patient, and you notice that this person's body basically has like no wrinkles. Like their face is like very like straight. They can't smile, nothing. What generalized rheumatologic disorder are you thinking about? I really hope you're thinking about scleroderma. Right? Scleroderma. Remember that scleroderma, right, can cause like a renal crisis because they can have like microvascular damage to like their kidneys, and then they get into trouble, right? So like scleroderma, renal crisis, it can cause like profound hypertension in these patients. So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And really, the way you treat a scleroderma renal problems is with like ACE inhibitors. Okay, so that's one thing you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind, because ACE inhibitors decrease intraglomerular hypertension, so that you don't get like I sort of talked about that, I believe, in my renal video. So basically, this the question I just brought up, right, it's about scleroderma. Scleroderma, right, the big things you want to know are like the two major types, right? So there's like the limited scleroderma. In fact, people prefer to call it like a limited systemic sclerosis. And then there's the diffuse scleroderma, which is the one that's bad, like super bad. That's like the diffuse scleroderma or the diffuse systemic sclerosis. Now, in terms of pathophysiology, again, like most rheumatologic disease, no one really knows the pathophys. But the thing is, at least from the papers and stuff I've read, if you want like the Cliff's Notes version, basically what the people think the pathophysiology represents is that you essentially have exposure to like some weird unknown antigen, And when you're exposed to that weird unknown antigen, your immune system sort of says, okay, let's go ahead and have some of our cells, like our lymphocytes, for example, begin to make certain cytokines, like TGF-beta. That TGF-beta, one of the evil things it does is that it tells fibroblasts to go make collagen. And as you tell your fibroblasts to go make collagen, well, badness happens. They begin to like deposit collagen like in your lungs, in your skin, in your esophageal muscles, right? So if you deposit like collagen in your lungs, right, you can get like interstitial lung disease. If you deposit that in your skin, you can get like the sclerodactyly, right? If you deposit that in your like esophageal muscles, right, you can basically get like incompetence of the lower esophageal sphincter. So you can basically get like really nasty like GERD slash I guess Barrett's esophagus with that. If you deposit those in your the collagen like in your blood vessels, you can begin to have like ischemic events, right? So you can have like Raynaud phenomenon. You can have because really, if you can have pulmonary hypertension, right? That's another thing that can arise. In fact, the most common cause of death is very high yield to know. The most common cause of death in patients that have scleroderma, especially like the diffuse scleroderma, is actually like respiratory failure because they get like just bad like pulmonary hypertension, like pulmonary fibrosis, right? So like interstitial lung disease from all that collagen deposition, and then they die, right? So that's the most common cause of death. Very high yield to know that, especially for step two and step three in patients like diffuse or systemic sclerosis. Right, so those are the big things you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind with scleroderma, right? But obviously, that's not all, unfortunately, that you need to know for NBME exams, right? So the key things you want to keep in mind, you want to know your antibodies, right? So like the diffuse scleroderma. In fact, let me talk about the easy one first. The limited scleroderma, also called limited systemic sclerosis. That one basically tends to affect three areas in the body. It affects the hands. It affects the forearm, so any part of your upper extremity that is distal to your elbow. So it affects the hands, the forearm, and the face. Those are the three big areas it affects. And for the most part, that's all it affects. So those people tend to have like, pretty decent life expectancy. But by definition, limited systemic sclerosis or like the limited scleroderma can also involve like visceral organs, but visceral organ involvement is usually like super late in disease. It's not something that sort of happens like early in disease. So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And this limited scleroderma is the one that's associated with the CREST syndrome, right? So like the calcinosis. So when you have like calcium deposits under your skin, and then like the Raynaud phenomenon where you get like vasospasm, right, of your like your digital vessels, especially when you come out into like cold weather or whatever. And then they can also have something called so that's the R. They can have esophageal dysmotility, right? So that can cause like GERD, that can cause Barrett's esophagus. They can have like the sclerodactyly, that's like the thick, taut, tight skin, right? And then they can get like telangiectasias. They can get like these weird blood vessels on their skin. But in addition to that, the limited scleroderma, right, the CREST scleroderma, is also associated with anti-centromere antibodies. That's one you definitely want to remember. Now contrast this with like the diffuse scleroderma, right? So the diffuse systemic sclerosis, where these people tend to have like they will have like involvement of like their skin, everything, but it can also get involvement of like their visceral organs, right? So they can have like involvement of the lungs, of the kidneys, of the heart. And these people tend to get like a rapidly, like these people die relatively quickly because those organs stop functioning, especially the lungs, right? They get pulmonary fibrosis, get interstitial lung disease, and then they're kind of screwed. And the key things you want to remember are the autoantibodies, right? For like the systemic sclerosis, like the diffuse systemic sclerosis, so the diffuse scleroderma. That one is associated with like anti-SEL70 antibodies. So those are like antibodies against like topoisomerase 1. They also make antibodies against like RNA pool 3. Okay? Those are the big ones you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, like I said, pulmonary fibrosis, pulmonary hypertension, they can get those with scleroderma, especially like the systemic sclerosis. These people, right, again, if they fibrose like their kidneys and like the vessels that feed their kidneys, they can get like a very bad like renal crisis that, again, you treat with an ACE inhibitor on NBME exams. It's very high yield to know that. And some other things you also want to keep at the back of your mind with scleroderma is like the Raynaud's phenomenon. They can actually integrate this with pharmacology really nicely on the NBMEs, because if you think about it, right, like if a person has Raynaud's phenomenon, I've repeated this across multiple podcasts, those people should not be giving drugs that can cause vasospasm, right? Classic ones are like your drugs for migraines, like your sumatriptan. Those people with a history of scleroderma should not get those drugs. Other drugs will also be your like ergot compounds, right? Like your ergotamines, like dihydroergotamine, those like vasospastic agents. You don't want to give those to people with Raynaud's phenomenon. And that also kind of explains why you can give like a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker as treatment for Raynaud's phenomenon, because it causes, those agents are cause a vasodilation. So those are things you all want to keep at the back of your mind with a scleroderma. I mean, like scleroderma, these people can also get like malabsorption, because again, if you fibrose your GI tract, bacteria will be able to overgrow, and that can begin to cause a lot of problems. Alternatively, as well, as you fibrose the blood vessels that feed your GI tract epithelium, right? You don't have like enough surface area for absorption of stuff, so you can have like fat malabsorption. So those people can have like steatorrhea and whatnot, right? So that's why patients with scleroderma can have like malabsorptive symptoms. So I think that's all I really want to say with scleroderma. I think that's probably more than enough. I will pick up, I promise, like I said, I will pick up from here in the next podcast. We'll keep talking about rheumatology. And as I round up, as I always mention, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams. Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3. And then also for like the preclinical exams you take in med school and the third year shelf exams. And then if you're a med student applying to residency, so like AMCAS apps, or I mean ERAS apps. And if you're a college student applying to med school, like AMCAS apps, I do offer like one-on-one like consulting and whatnot for those, right? So like prep for interviews, cleaning up personal statements and applications, sort of basically like presenting you in the best possible light in an application. I can help with those things. I mean, I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 medical school for about a year, so I have a lot of experience sifting through applications. Now, other things I also offer tutoring for, like organic chemistry, biochem, physiology, histology, or if you're preparing for like the internal medicine board exam, so the in-training exam for internal medicine, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for those. So those are all the things I offer, like I guess outside services, I guess, if you can think of them as related to the podcast website. I'm really excited that we'll be getting to episode 100 at the next podcast, and I'll try to hopefully get that done relatively soon. I'm just kind of sad with the slow pace of our podcast website, because I've just not had the time. It's just been really hard, especially on ICU. It's just terrible work-life balance. So you just really don't have time to make as many podcasts, because trust me, like my brain is chock full of stuff I want to make podcasts for, but it's just literally, there's literally no time to make these podcasts. But hopefully as this ICU rotation winds down, there'll be a pretty good increase in the number of podcasts I make. So I wish you all the best. I really hope that someone other than the Golden State Warriors wins the Western Conference this year. But I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful weekend, and God bless you. Thank you.